Chapter 11. Propaganda and Politics. Politically, the war was complicated, with a strange conglomeration of bedfellows. The FNLA and UNITA were supported at one time by the United States, China, Romania, North Korea, France, Israel, West Germany, Senegal, Uganda, Zaire, Zambia, Tanzania, and South Africa. The MPLA was supported by the Soviet Union, Cuba, East Germany, Algeria, Guinea, and several Eastern European countries. Throughout the war, there was a constant sorting out, and dozens of countries eventually shifted their support to the MPLA. On October 24th, the Chinese withdrew from the Angola War, their advisors packing and leaving, holding a press conference at Nijili Airport as they left. France was intrigued by the smell of Angolan oil and Zairean minerals, and predisposed to involvement in Angola by its long history of meddling in the affairs of young African countries. Footnote: more than any European power, France has remained active in the affairs of newly independent African countries. French army units have been garrisoned in Niger, contended with rebels in Chad, and been on call for crises in other areas. French diplomats and technical advisors have been correspondingly influential in the new governments, while the French intelligence service has maintained agents throughout and sent mercenary squads into various situations, the Comoro Islands, Cabinda, and elsewhere. End footnote. Like the United States, France saw the Angolan War as a chance to ingratiate itself with Mobutu. In August, French intelligence directors had met with the CIA's deputy director, Vernon Walters, and obtained his promise that the CIA would give them $250,000 as proof of the United States' good faith in Angola. The money was delivered, although it was clear to no one, possibly not even to General Walters, why the United States had to prove its good faith in Angola to the French. A liaison evolved in which the CIA briefed the French intelligence service in detail about its Angola program, while the French listened carefully but told the CIA nothing about their own activities in Angola and Cabinda. France did provide NTAC anti-tank missiles, 120-millimeter mortar rounds, and ammunition for Mobutu's Panhard armored cars, which it asked the CIA to haul from East France to Kinshasa. In December, France donated 4 missile-firing helicopters, which were delivered to Kinshasa by the CIA without pilots or ground crews. Black African leaders watched the birthing of the new nation in their midst with sympathy and jealous interest. By 1975, they had learned painful lessons about the competition of West and East in Africa. Almost to a country, they had been exploited in civil wars, coups, arms races, and competitive aid programs by the Soviet Union, United States, and various European, Asian, and Latin American countries. They had, of course, encouraged the Angolan liberation movements in their struggles against Portuguese colonialism, and when civil war erupted in July 1975, most had supported an embargo on the delivery of additional arms to the Angolan factions. Most were predisposed to resent outside interference in what they regarded as a purely African matter. The flagrant Soviet arms program was at first greeted with noisy indignation. All but the staunchest Soviet allies protested the Soviet interference in Angola. The new government of Nigeria expressed its concern. President Nyerere of Tanzania made public speeches criticizing the Soviet arms program. Idi Amin of Uganda castigated the Soviet Union and stormily threatened to sever relations. Egypt and the Sudan denied them overflight clearances for their arms flights to the MPLA. The United States launched a major political effort to embroil and entrap as many countries as it could into opposition of the MPLA. Secret agents were sent to Third World conferences, including the Non-Aligned Nations Summit in Sri Lanka and the Organization of African Unity in Addis Ababa. United States ambassadors throughout Africa were brought on board in varying degrees, receiving carefully tailored messages which were formulated by the CIA and delivered to the State Department through the working group, ordering them to use whatever leverage they could manage with their host governments to prejudice them against the MPLA. Savimbi caused the United States a minor embarrassment in September when he sent feelers to the MPLA for a negotiated solution. The CIA learned of this move through an article in the World Press, and a Kinshasa station officer promptly interrogated Savimbi. We wanted no soft allies in our war against the MPLA. Similarly, on October 22nd, when an MPLA delegation arrived in Washington to plead the MPLA's potential friendliness towards the United States, it was received by a low-level State Department officer, who reported perfunctorily to the working group. President Kaunda was a potential problem. While he sympathized with Savimbi, he was primarily concerned with getting his copper to the sea, and with the Benguela Railroad closed, his only alternative was the expensive and humiliating route through Rhodesia and South Africa. On September 10th, he gave Savimbi 60 days, until Angolan independence, to get the Benguela Railroad open. Otherwise, he could not guarantee continued support. To the CIA, Kaunda's ultimatum was a challenge. How could we get him so involved he could never defect? The key seemed to be the transshipment of arms through Zambia. Kaunda had publicly supported the international embargo against the shipment of arms to Angola, and it was felt that if one plane load of arms could be introduced through Zambia, with Kaunda's permission, he would be irreversibly committed to UNITA's support. Pregnant, we said in CIA headquarters. At first, the African leaders did not know about the United States arms program, thanks to our ruse of working through Kinshasa. Similarly, the Soviets tried to hide their shipments through the Congo, Brazzaville, but the size of their program made it impossible to conceal. And, of course, the CIA launched a major propaganda effort to expose the Soviet arms shipments. Propaganda experts in the CIA station in Kinshasa busily planted articles in the Kinshasa newspapers, Elimo and Salongo. These were recopied into agency cables and sent on to European, Asian, and South American stations, where they were secretly passed to recruited journalists representing major news services who saw to it that many were replayed in the world press. Similarly, the Lusaka station placed a steady flow of stories in Zambian newspapers and then relayed them to major European newspapers. In Kinshasa, Ray Child's prolific pen and fertile imagination produced a stream of punchy articles and clever operations to spearhead the agency's propaganda effort. For example, he procured a mimeograph machine for FNLA headquarters in Kinshasa and produced leaflets, which were dropped from airplanes over Luanda itself. The first such leaflet was unaccountably read verbatim over the MPLA's Radio Luanda the next morning, provoking a ripple of laughter in CIA stations throughout Europe and Africa when they heard of it. The propaganda output from Lusaka was voluminous and imaginative, if occasionally beyond credibility. In late September, Lusaka news stories began to charge that Soviets were advising MPLA forces inside Angola. This was at first a plausible line, and Lusaka kept it going. Certainly, Soviet advisors might have been inside Angola, although we had no evidence to that effect. The world press dutifully picked up Lusaka's stories of Soviet advisors, while we at headquarters watched nervously, preferring that propaganda ploys have at least some basis in fact. Then 2 months later, Lusaka reported that 20 Soviet advisors and 35 Cubans had been captured when UNITA took Malanje. UNITA spokesman gave this information to David Ottaway, who was visiting Lusaka, and it was published in the November 22nd edition of the Washington Post. The Post also printed the TASS denial the same day, carrying stories from the world's two largest intelligence services in the same issue. Unwitting that the first story came from the CIA and that it was false, aware that TASS was the Soviet propaganda arm, but not sure that this time it was telling the truth. UNITA had captured no Soviet advisors, nor had it taken Malanje. World interest in the story put UNITA under uncomfortable pressure, and the CIA Lusaka station abashedly let the story die a quiet death. Another Lusaka fabrication accused Cuban soldiers of committing atrocities in Angola. It mentioned rape and pillage. Then its stories became more specific. Reporting, a totally fictitious incident, in which Cuban soldiers had raped some Ovimbundu girls. Subsequently, it wrote that some of those same soldiers had been captured and tried before a tribunal of Ovambundu women. Lusaka kept this story going endlessly throughout the program. Later, Carol Murphy, a Washington Post stringer who had covered Luanda, told me the Cuban soldiers had universally fallen in love with Angola and were singularly well-behaved. Footnote: Ms. Murphy had no relationship whatsoever with the CIA. Our conversation occurred in late 1976, after I had decided to leave the CIA. End footnote. The only atrocity we were able to document had Cubans as victims rather than criminals. 16 Cuban soldiers captured in October were executed by UNITA soldiers at the end of the war. Bubba Sanders returned to headquarters shortly after I did and began to work on a white paper, which the FNLA could present to the United Nations General Assembly. A white paper is one in which the source, and therefore the potential bias, is not concealed. The FNLA would readily admit their sponsorship of the document. The CIA's role would be concealed. Bubba collected information from agency intelligence reports about Soviet arms shipments and included photographs of Russian ships and weapons taken by journalists who were on the CIA payroll and had visited Luanda on the basis of their press credentials. One of Africa Division's translators put the text of Bubba's message into African-sounding French, that is, with idioms and expressions which would be used by a literate man in Kinshasa, but not in Paris. Potts enjoyed this sort of thing. He supervised Bubba closely, questioning him in detail during each staff meeting, stubbornly insisting that no corners be cut, that the document meet rigorous standards. The two of them argued about paper and type, as well as text and layout. The end product was assembled in a small folder, printed on rough paper identical to that used by one of the Kinshasa printing offices, and even printed with machines similar to those used in Kinshasa. The cover bore the picture of a dead soldier on the Kahito battlefield. The white paper was barely off the press when FNLA representatives arrived in New York in late September to lobby at the United Nations General Assembly. They were broke. Bubba Sanders set up a small task force in a Manhattan hotel room to direct our United Nations propaganda operation. In daily meetings, the New York officers secretly funded the FNLA delegation and plotted strategy as they made contacts at the United Nations and with the New York newspapers. They distributed the white paper in the UN and to the U.S. press. They also toured Africa with it and distributed copies to the Chinese. The UNITA representatives also arrived broke. And although we did not have a paper for them to distribute, the New York officers provided funds and guidance. Far more capable than the FNLA, UNITA representatives began to establish useful contacts. Both delegations were supplied with up-to-date intelligence. News and propaganda releases were cabled directly from the African stations to the permanent CIA offices in the Pan Am building and two nearby skyscrapers on 3rd Avenue and East 42nd Street. The MPLA and Soviets were active too, but defensively so. Although they managed to prevent an open debate of Angola on the floor of the General Assembly, they could not check the momentum of sympathy which UNITA and the FNLA began to enjoy. Secretary General Waldheim expressed his concern and announced that the United Nations would send a fact-finding mission into Angola. During a staff meeting, I voiced my concern to Potts. Were we on safe ground, paying agents to propagandize the New York press? The agency had recently been warned against running operations inside the United States and propagandizing the American public. Potts seemed unconcerned. "We were safe enough," he said, "as long as we could plausibly claim that our intent was to propagandize foreigners at the United Nations." I wasn't satisfied with Potts's attitude toward the situation in New York. It seemed to me that our propaganda operation was leading us onto explosively dangerous ground. On October 2nd, the New York base telephoned headquarters, advising us that it was sending the two UNITA representatives down to Washington for the weekend for some medical treatment and to talk to members of the Black Caucus in Washington, seeking introductions to key senators and administration officials. The New York base requested that I meet them and give them whatever support they needed. I refused. After the call, I went in to see Carl, then Potts. They both agreed that the UNITA representatives had to be reined in. We sent a cable to the New York base reminding them that lobbying in the United States by CIA agents was not permitted. On Monday, an officer from New York arrived at headquarters, and I learned with a jolt that it was I who was out of step. To begin with, the two UNITA reps had spent the weekend in Washington after all. The officer cheerfully admitted that he had given them money for the trip because he claimed they were coming anyway, with or without his approval, and besides, they were damned effective. He described their progress in New York with infectious enthusiasm. Potts bought the whole show. He and the officer devised a neat solution to our little CIA charter problem. In order to keep the two delegations doing their good work in New York and in Washington, and still protect the CIA from any blowback, funds would be channeled to them via overseas banks. The officer at first resisted, on the grounds that this was cumbersome, that he or one of his assistants could just slip them some money when they needed it, say $500 every few days. But Potts insisted, and after the officer went back to New York, the task force worked out the details by cabling New York, Lusaka, Kinshasa, and key European stations. Each delegation opened a bank account in Europe, to which European-based CIA finance officers could make regular deposits. Thereafter, the CIA could plausibly deny that it had funded anyone's propagandists in the United States. It would be extremely difficult for any investigators to prove differently. This arrangement continued throughout the duration of the program, long after the UN General Assembly closed. The UNITA delegates in New York and Washington were increasingly effective. They managed to see State Department officials, White House representatives, and congressmen, as well as American journalists. Care was taken by their CIA case officers not to record their visits to Washington, although some visits were reported in official memos written by unwitting State Department officers and White House staffers, who did not know they had been visited by CIA agents. UNITA's news from Angola continued to be drawn from CIA propaganda, fed to them by their case officers in New York. In January 1976, Director Colby testified before the House Select Committee on Intelligence saying, quote, "We have taken particular caution to ensure that our operations are focused abroad and not at the United States to influence the opinion of the American people about things from the CIA point of view." End quote. Footnote. Final report of the Senate Select Committee to Study Governmental Operations with Respect to Intelligence Activities, April 26, 1976, page 129. End footnote. A remarkable statement in view of what we had been doing in the task force. Footnote. Director Colby received copies of all IA feature cables and memoranda. End footnote. It was impossible to measure the full impact in America of the FNLA and UNITA propagandists, except perhaps by the response of American citizens who were inspired to enlist to fight communists in Angola. The news services reported that Roy Ennis of the Congress on Racial Equality was seeking 1,000 volunteers to join the FNLA in Angola. Another group began training in jungle tactics on a farm in North Carolina. Adventurers, self-styled mercenaries, and restless American citizens began to contact the FNLA, and eventually a few made it to the FNLA fighting front in northern Angola, where several met tragic deaths. We had other lines into the American media. For example, a European film crew was sent to Silva Porto to make a film about the war. Featuring Cuban soldiers Savimbi had captured, the documentary it produced was quite successful on European television. It came to the attention of the Voice of America, which proposed to show it in the United States. After discussing the pros and cons, the working group decided to let it happen. Subsequently, parts of the film appeared on an American television show. Another time, a European CIA station cabled headquarters, advising that a journalist was en route to Washington with an FNLA story. When he arrived, the task force deputy chief, Paul Foster, met him secretly in Washington, then brought an article he had written back to CIA headquarters, where a task force linguist translated it into passable English. The next day, Foster returned it to the reporter, who sold it to the Washington Post, which printed it. The article covered several columns, reading in part, "A stern countenance, mustachioed and goateed, a stocky frame in a Mao tunic, a sternness in his bearing and in his remarks, often belied by great bursts of truly African laughter. Holden Roberto is a strange blend of war chief and Alabama Baptist preacher, but a man who obviously inspires a quasi-mystical fervor in his men." Question. But you have South Africans on your side. Roberto strikes the table in his headquarters violently and sends the general staff maps flying. He seems gripped by a cold rage and starts to walk back and forth across the room, his hands behind his back. "You saw the South Africans? Did you see them? I say, in the zones which we control, we, the FNLA. Go and see at Savimbi's headquarters. I am telling you that we have no South Africans or Rhodesians among us." At first we were successful in keeping our hand in the war hidden, while exposing the Soviet arms program. However, cracks began to appear in our cover facade in early September, and the working group discussed ploys to cope. When State Department representatives reported the department was receiving inquiries from the press about Angola, the CIA presented them with Working Group Paper No. 18, which suggested lines to be used in formal press statements. We could refuse to comment. We could categorically deny U.S. involvement. Or we could state that the United States had supported the Alvor Accord, which permitted the three liberation movements to participate equally in preparing Angola for independence. But the Soviet Union had delivered arms to the MPLA, producing heavy fighting. Angola's neighbors were concerned that the Soviet Union was attempting to carve out a dominant position in Angola. We would add that we were sympathetic, but we had not supplied U.S. arms to any of the liberation movements. Whichever, we should emphasize the Soviet Union, so it would not look as though we were attacking a minor liberation movement. The State Department, a few days later, reported it had issued a statement refusing to substantiate press inquiries and denying United States involvement. "We have not been in the business of providing arms to the Angolan movements. However, we have received reports that one of the movements, the MPLA, has for some time been receiving large shipments of weapons from the Soviet Union. It is understandable if African governments are concerned about this development, and we are sympathetic to those concerns." In the field, our security was fairly good. We and our allies had control over the only transportation into the fighting areas, especially into Silva Porto, and could restrict those areas from all but a few selected reporters, or the extremely hardy individuals who were willing to go in overland. However, one European reporter, whom we knew only as Germani, began focusing on Kinshasa itself, and was scurrying about town with a good instinct for where we were hiding the stories. The Kinshasa station reported his presence, and the working group discussed the threat he posed. It would be easy to have Mobutu throw him out of the country. Could we get by with asking Mobutu to do it? Germani wasn't American. Did we dare have cables on record ordering the station to pull strings and have a legitimate European reporter thrown out of Kinshasa? The press would be extremely angry if it ever found out. The working group stalled, wondering why the field hadn't thought of this solution without headquarters guidance. They were in daily contact with Roberto and his deputies and could easily plant the idea. They could see Mobutu. There would be no record. Chiefs of station are supposed to have an instinct for such things. Like magic, Germani was expelled from Kinshasa on November 22nd. Without any cables or memoranda being written at headquarters, the string was pulled, the problem solved, and there was nothing in CIA records proving how it had happened. Footnote. This is the way the ouster of Nkrumah was handled in Ghana in 1966. The 40 Committee had met and rejected an agency proposal to oust Nkrumah. The Accra station was nevertheless encouraged by headquarters to maintain contact with dissidents of the Ghanaian army for the purpose of gathering intelligence on their activities. It was given a generous budget and maintained intimate contact with the plotters as a coup was hatched, So close was the station's involvement that it was able to coordinate the recovery of some classified Soviet military equipment by the United States as the coup took place. The station even proposed to headquarters, through back channels, that a squad be on hand at the moment of the coup to storm the Chinese embassy, kill everyone inside, steal their secret records, and blow up the building to cover the fact. This proposal was quashed. But inside CIA headquarters, the Accra station was given full, if unofficial, credit for the eventual coup, in which 8 Soviet advisors were killed. None of this was adequately reflected in the agency's written records. This technique has worked for the agency in many other situations. Perhaps an irritating politician in a far corner of the world is magically eliminated, while the CIA records show no evidence of involvement in the crime. When done skillfully, it is also the key to the individual case officer's rationalization of his conduct, his, quote, plausible denial, unquote, to his own conscience, as though he were not responsible. He can say, "We talked about the problem Germani was causing, or Lumumba, Trujillo, Schneider, et al., but it never even occurred to me to suggest that anything be done about it." This is my own theory of what really happened in the assassination of Lumumba. The CIA plotted to poison him, but lost its nerve. The now public record shows that CIA officers discussed the Lumumba threat with other Congolese politicians. They did the rest. But of course the case officers are responsible. The things wouldn't have been done if they had not been there, setting the stage. For example, in Vietnam I inherited an operational relationship with a sadistic police officer who occasionally mutilated prisoners in a CIA safe house called the Pink House. The police officer was heavily funded by the CIA, which vouched for him to his superiors in Saigon. Without this support, he would not have held his post. But a succession of CIA case officers had absolved themselves of responsibility for his sadistic orgies by rationalizing that they were only supporting him for his intelligence activities and were not responsible for his other actions. End footnote. Increasingly, the propaganda war became uphill work. On September 10th, when the FNLA retreated from Cajito the second time, it left behind crates of munitions which bore fresh U.S. Air Force shipping labels. The MPLA displayed these trophies to Western journalists, and the press picked up our scent. Nor were the newspapers idle. In Washington and New York, IA Feature was increasingly exposed with accurate reports of our program, our budget, even the amounts of money in our budget. The New York Times seemed to have a particularly direct line to the working group, and the thought that we might have a deep throat in our midst added some desperately needed excitement to the working group sessions. While IA Feature was being described in the New York Times, the presence of South African soldiers in Angola became known. On November 22nd, a journalist, Ken Bridgefield, filed a story in the Washington Post from Lusaka, reporting that South African soldiers were fighting in Angola. The propaganda and political war was lost in that stroke. There was nothing the Lusaka station could invent that would be as damaging to the other side as our alliance with the hated South Africans was to our cause. Nigeria, the economic giant of Black Africa, and the United States' second most important source of petroleum, emphatically shifted its support to the MPLA, providing it with $20 million in aid. A crowd of Nigerians demonstrated before the American Embassy in Lagos. Tanzania announced plans to train MPLA soldiers in Tanzania in a joint program with the Soviets. Idi Amin reversed his decision to expel the Soviets from Uganda. And when the Soviets publicly defended their program in late December, Amin supported them. Other countries began to recognize the MPLA as the legitimate rulers of Angola.